from runasradio.com, you're listening to Run As Radio, the internet audio talk show for IT professionals with Richard Campbell. This is Brandon Nguyen announcing show number 480, Isolated User Mode in Windows 10 with guest Mark Manassi, recorded Monday, June 20th, 2016. Run As Radio is produced each week by Pwop Productions, providing professional media and podcasting services online at pwop.com. You can follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/runasradio.
Thank you, Brandon. This is Richard Campbell, and thanks for listening to Run As Radio. I'm bringing back the troublemaker. Mark Manassi is returning. Did his first lecture about computers in 1973, and it's been all downhill from there. Welcome back, sir.
Hey, it's good to hear from y'all again out there in Radio Land.
And you're moved.
I have. Well, didn't you also? Because Skype says you're... I thought you were in Vancouver, and you're like, Quilquemot or something. Did you give Richmond to the Indians or something? What happened?
Nah. Coquitlam, which is also a First Nations word, is the suburb of Vancouver that I live in.
I see.
But before we go immediately off the rails, I gotta read a comment from a listener, and this is actually off of show 468, which is a show I did with Paula Janowski, which we both know. We talked a lot about ransomware.
So you're going to read a comment about a show somebody liked that I didn't do. I see. Okay.
That you didn't do, but you get to listen in, and perhaps you have some insight, you know, some commentary on this. This is from Alessandro, who says, on the ransomware prevention front, and he's big on the whole idea of restricting updates to file permissions.
Yeah.
You know, if you start using, ransomware only works if they can rewrite existing files. So if you don't have update permissions, kind of cripples the whole thing. He's also a big fan of the Enhanced Mitigation Experience Toolkit, EMET.
EMET's actually been around for quite a while.
Yeah.
I first heard EMET like 5 or 6 years ago. There's some really, really good stuff in there, and it really should be looked at. But, you know, that's all good stuff, and we should do those things. But I think we're getting to one of those parts of history where we're so concerned that we've created so much security that we lock ourselves out of our own stuff, or applications that aren't really new start not working so well. Because one of the things we've never had in the Windows world is very good feedback from apps about why things aren't working, right? So you may have an HTML editor that you've been using for the last 5 years. You turn this stuff on, it stops working.
Yeah.
You know, I hate to say this, but there's this seesaw, and you've heard me say this a million times. There's this seesaw when it comes to mitigating security risks. A long time ago, a lot of us said, users are too stupid. We can't possibly put that in their laps. No. Richard, it's funny, but I mean, I strongly mean this. I think that we've lost the war when we feel that way.
Right.
I wrote a column about this in 2002 about how it was one of the viruses that were spreading because of attachments, where people were just opening attachments, saying, oh, these users are so stupid. And what I said at the time is, you know what? It's not that hard. It's just that people make it hard. And I said, you know, we should have there's a little 15-minute lecture, 3-question quiz at the end. And if you pass it, we'll give you an email certificate. Department of Motor Vehicles does that here in America. Who does IDs in Canada? Is your driver's license largely it?
Yeah, provincial. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Right. So our states generate, they should be kicking out these email certificates. And then when you're sending email, you can send it out certified. And that means now that in Lookout, then you could end up automatically creating a folder called certified mail from other certified people.
Right.
And then there's the other stuff. Nothing wrong with it, but you're going to look at it secondarily.
And you're going to be cautious around it too.
Exactly.
Because how much of this could just be mitigated by teaching our people better?
Oh, and not just that. Think about it. Because if it's a certificate authority that's doing this, we can revoke somebody's certificate in a twinkling.
Right.
You know, so I mean, Outlook gets a little slower because it's got to go look for krills now and then. But I mean, that was just one example. I think that was a great idea then. I wish we were doing it now.
Yeah.
My point wasn't so much that. My point was people can be taught the basic things. We should be teaching users, stop clicking random stuff. You know, that if it looks bad, don't touch it.
I totally agree. Yeah. Education is the empower. And Alessandro, thank you so much for your comment. A Run As Radio mug is on its way to you. And if you'd like a Run As Radio mug, write a comment on the website at runasradio.com. And if we read it on the show, we'll send you a mug. And I'm going to send you a mug too, Mr. Manassi. All the shows you've done with me, I don't think I've ever sent you a Run As Radio mug.
Well, there you go. Let's talk about some security stuff.
Love to. What are you thinking?
Well, so here's the thing. Okay, the topic for today is called either isolated user mode in Windows 10 and Server 2016, or virtual security mode, or how to use something you already paid for to keep your ass out of trouble with Windows 10.
So what's the difference between the two modes?
Strictly speaking, part of this conversation, this is an hour and a half talk. I'm going to try to get done very quickly. So I've got some notes to contain myself, all right?
Okay.
Part of why I'm fascinated by this is that you know I love operating systems. I just want to know how the leg bone connects to the ankle bone.
Absolutely.
And so I want to give all of our listeners a little feel into that. Basically, so there are a couple of phrases. Those phrases have kind of appeared over the process of creating this stuff. They're still considered separate pieces, but I think by the time Windows 11 comes around, it'll just be one checkbox. So don't worry too much about that. The thing is this, central problem. Windows and every other operating system has always had, and I'm going to use a security word here, secrets. Now, you and I know what they are, but for the folks in, back home, we used to say stuff like, you type in a password, we store it somewhere, we don't want people to see it, right?
Right.
But there's not just that, but there's, you know, certificates and stuff like that. So collectively, little bits of data that identify you, or that can be used to decrypt or encrypt you or something like that, those are collectively called secrets. And I wish we didn't use the phrase, because the average bear looks at this and says, secrets. Windows is keeping secrets from, no, Windows is keeping your secrets, and it's a good thing, right?
Right.
So the notion is that when you or I log into Windows, it doesn't bug us every 5 seconds for our password. It stuffs it away in RAM somewhere. Now, where does this store this, Richard?
Registry?
Well, over the years. Okay, the answer is, it's a secret they can't tell you.
It's a secret.
No, I don't know. I swear to God. So back like when Windows 2000 came out, there was a bunch of stuff like, remember the encrypting file system? We all use that, right? And the key for that had to be hidden somewhere.
Right.
And then there's stuff about when you log on, there's your NTLM password or your hash or whatever. And this is big stuff because, I mean, everybody who's listening to this has heard the frightening phrase, pass the hash. In the Kerberos world, we now have pass the ticket, which is the same sort of thing.
Yes.
You know, Kerberos tickets. That's another great example of a secret that we don't want the bad guys to get a hold of. And what does Microsoft do with it? Well, honestly, Microsoft used to do what's called obscuring, which is a fancy word for they hide it. They took the EFS encrypting certificate and they busted it up into, if I remember correctly, 15 pieces, and they hid it in different places in the registry.
Wow.
I know. Like, who would ever find it? Yeah, sure. That's why God made German undergraduates, you know? So, you know, inside of 3 months, someone's found it.
Right.
Which is why one of the reasons Microsoft would say, oh, install XP Service Pack 1, install XP Service Pack 2, install this service pack, this roll-up, is that we found a new place to hide it.
Right.
But that doesn't work ultimately. Anybody who learns security, right, one of the top 10 things we learn is that security through obscurity just isn't going to work.
It isn't going to work.
Well, it does, though, because, you know, we obscure our passwords, but we want to reduce that as much as possible. And so what did they do back in Vista for this? Well, back in Vista, we had BitLocker, which is a kind of cool tool.
Right.
But BitLocker needs to hide your disk encryption key somewhere. And what was the answer there? Hint is part of the next generation secure computing platform, codename Palladium. How's your Windows trivia?
No, that's a long time ago, man.
So back in the 2004, yes, XP is a piece of crap security-wise, but we just released Service Pack 4.
Right.
And Service Pack 2, rather. And I'm thinking NT4.
And yeah.
Boy, is it wonderful. And for our next plan, when whatever the code name was for Vista, and then we're going to put a special chip on your motherboard called a Trusted Platform Module, a TPM chip.
Right.
And it's interesting. I mean, it's all it does, right? All a TPM chip does is it has some space, just hold some numbers.
Right.
Of course, your password, you say, my password's not a number. It is a number. We take whatever you type in and make it into a big number or something like that. And so we can store those things. And in order to get the information out of the TPM chip, when you fire up your Vista or later system, then your TPM chip goes out and it touches a lot of things in your computer and says, wait a minute, BIOS changed since yesterday. Or wait a minute, the super block on NTFS changed since yesterday. Or the MBR did, the master boot record or something like that. These are all little places that can be easily, little footprints that can be looked at. And with the TPM chip, the Trusted Platform Module 1.2 chip, and BitLocker says, if any of those things change, I'm not coughing up the key.
Right.
And at that point, you get, you know, white text on a black background, which is never the beginning of a good day at the office.
So it's always bad.
Exactly. And that's when it wants your, I'm going to get this wrong, but I think is it 48 character? It's like 48 characters or 64 characters. You have a backup BitLocker password. And when you first BitLockered something, it spat this thing out. I forget whether it's 64 characters or 48 characters or whatever. And you get to type that. And so you got it. You need it nearby. I keep mine on a piece of paper taped under my laptop so that I get access to it at any time. And so
security by obscurity.
That's right. Well, it's not just obscurity. I'm right here. So you're not touching my laptop, Jack, so you can't see what's underneath it. But anyway, so the point is, that was a way to store secrets. But it's limited.
Right.
Interesting thing about the TPM chip, too, by the way, I don't want to get too far afield, but the TPM chip has to be soldered to the motherboard.
Right.
You know, for a while there, the NVIDIA guys were saying, oh, well, you know, we'll put a chip so that you could – because when Vista came out, very few laptops had TPM chips. And so you had to buy something new and expensive to even play with BitLocker properly. Yeah, you know, of course, you could remember codes and things like that or store it on a USB key, but that was not the way to go.
Right.
And so for a while, there was like NVIDIA said, we've got a board, but no. That's not soldered onto the motherboard. So the 1.2 chip was the first one, and it's still important even now in a lot of security stuff. But we needed something bigger. Microsoft needed – I say we, I don't work for Microsoft. Microsoft needed something bigger. And so the notion here is that – oh, here's another example where this goes wrong. Have you seen the DMA cards for laptops that will unlock your laptop?
No.
So you know how
– these are internal to your laptop?
Well, here's the idea. Fancy laptops have a little slot. It used to be called a – PCMCIA slot. It became a card bus slot, right? You know, the one your mom has doesn't have it. The ones you and I have PC card slots.
Right.
And so here's what it does. You log in, you've locked your laptop. Your password, remember, is sitting somewhere in memory. And it's fairly well known where this is. It's actually a number of places, but it's a small number of places.
Right.
Somebody comes up and shoves this card into your laptop. It does a plug and play analysis, plug and play enumeration, and it says, oh, hi. I'm a direct memory access device. And the operating system says, why? So you are. You all have a good day now. Gets it running on the system.
Mm-hmm.
What this device then does is it knows where to find those passwords, locates the password, and unlocks your laptop.
Okay.
Which means you got to take the laptop with you to the bathroom. You just, you know, can't fear. So what to do about this? What's interesting is this is a problem in every computer you ever heard of. The Mac's got this problem. Linux would have these problems, etc. And the first operating system on the planet to mitigate it was Windows 8.1, believe it or not.
Hmm.
Windows 8.1 said, oh, I see that I'm locked. I see you're a DMA device. I recognize who you are, but you can't do anything until the user logs in, which is brilliant. It's amazing that Windows 8 doesn't get a lot of respect, but from a
No, it takes a beating, let's be honest.
Yes. And deservedly so. But if you care about security, there were some major good reasons to go to Windows 8 and some more major good reasons to go to 8.1. And of course, reasons to go to Windows 10.
Right.
Now, Microsoft wanted to take that stuff a step further. Because, you know, another thing we've got to worry about is what if the code gets corrupted? A lot of what we do is we look at code signing certificates. That means we've got to recalculate hashes and decrypt things. And what if that code has been corrupted? Well, at that point, it's game over. So the notion was Microsoft created, and hang on to your seats here, folks. This is the bizarre part. Microsoft created a place that is outside of your computer's memory.
What?
So you're running Windows 10. You're running Server 2016. You've got this stuff set up. You have to turn it on. It's not on by default. And it essentially takes the secrets and puts them in an alternate universe. But wait, there's more. There's a version of the code that checks code signing. And that is code that sits out in that alternate universe. It is essentially running in a virtual machine, but it's not a Windows virtual machine. It's almost not an operating system.
Wow.
It's exactly. Isn't this cool?
It's bizarre.
If you shove that DMA device into your computer, it'll say, that memory doesn't exist, dude. Here is a toy many of our listeners will have played with. I assume you've played with Mimikatz just a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So for those who don't know, Mimikatz is a cool little utility written by either a French guy or a French Canadian guy. I'm not sure where he's from. And it lets you do all kinds of cool stuff, including it will retrieve all your secrets. It'll show you all your secrets, which is kind of
right.
So it's a good guy white hat tool to show you what the bad guys are doing.
But also, I mean, I've recovered license keys with it and things. Like, it's quite useful.
It absolutely is. It absolutely is. And I can't recommend it highly enough.
Absolutely. And Mark, give me 1 second to pay the bills here, because this episode of Run As Radio is brought to you by Chef, the automation platform for the DevOps workflow. You can use Chef to automate and manage it all. Infrastructure, run and time environments, and applications. Chef works in the cloud or in your data center, on physical servers, virtual machines, and containers. Get started today with Chef at chef.io/runasradio. Okay. So we've got this space that doesn't exist, but yet it does.
Yeah. So what I was saying was that if you were to run Mimikatz and you say, pull up my NTLM password, which is the easiest thing you can do. It's like, oh, you nobody home.
It's not there.
Yeah, it was just, this is fascinating stuff. This is really, really, really cool. Yeah, I'll see if I can, again, get through this quickly because I can talk about this a great, like, this really excites me a lot.
Sure.
So here's the Notion idea. The idea is we take all this stuff out of the computer. We create an alternate universe where code and data can kind of live in this separate virtual machine that is not Windows and is very different than Windows. So in short, a very simple virtual machine stores data and runs a little bit of code, some of the code signing stuff. In Windows, or indeed any operating system, if I said, here's OS 2, here's Linux, here's Android, here's Mac OS, you'd say, where's the software development kit? I want to write some code. I never understand an operating system until I do. Well, how about this new universe? You know what? You can't write code for it. The only people who can write code for it are Microsoft with a certificate that they have and they don't rent out.
Right.
And hardwired into this operating system is the fact that there are only four possible applications. Four is the number, and the number is four. Three is not enough.
Right.
Five is wrong. Six is right out. And so the way they're identified is they've got numbers. There's zero through three. This is so hardcore. It's like a bad science fiction movie. It's like, run application two. Not two. All right. So application zero is the tiny operating system.
Okay.
You start that up, you wake the thing up, and one of the things it has in it is that special code that says, I'm going to do code signing, checking, but I'm doing it out in the alternate universe, so I can't be messed with.
Right.
The second one turns on the secrets, so the secrets vault appears. And the number two and number three, the third and fourth ones, are part of something in virtual machines called guarded fabric. If we have time, we'll talk about those guys.
Wow.
Now, how does all this happen? You're like, wait a minute, hang on. Like, where do I get – is this off in the cloud or something? No, it's not. To understand this, we have to go back in time 10 years. We'll have some newspapers running backwards. It's just about this time, and you and I are in Boston for the 2006 Tech Ed.
I remember.
Indeed. I think I was doing your speaker idol thing.
I think you were, yeah.
And at the time, Jeff Woolsey, a guy we didn't really know yet, was standing up at the booth talking about Hyper-V and how Hyper-V was going to be the thing that was going to kick VMware's butt. Now, as always, if Microsoft is going to horn in on somebody who owns 95% of the market share,
right,
they need some gotta-have-it feature that the other guy doesn't have. And Microsoft thought they were wrong. But Microsoft thought that the answer would be that they would be a far more secure virtual machine infrastructure, hypervisor is the phrase, a far more secure than anybody else's. And Woolsey would talk about how he could have a fair-sized Server 2008 box, still in beta, not yet out, and it could have 15 different virtual machines, virtual servers running, and they could be hacked from here to Sunday. But none of them could jailbreak out. They'd have their hackedness inside their virtual machines.
Right.
They couldn't get past the infrastructure. And I thought, you know, I've never really heard about that happening with VMware ESX, but what the heck? Sounds like a cool thing. Want to play with it. But we never heard much about it because it didn't turn out to be a big seller. But it happens in the background. And here's where it manifests. Let's say that you're running Windows 8, 8.1, Windows 10. And you decide to turn on Hyper-V, or for that matter, you're running Server 2008 or 2012 or whatever, and you decide to turn on Hyper-V.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in your mind, probably, certainly in my mind, the kind of diagram I think of is that there's the hardware, on top of the hardware is the operating system, on top of the operating system is the virtual machine thingy that lets me create virtual machines. And it's just an application like Chrome or something like that. But if we paid attention back in 06, then Woolsey had a diagram about what really happens. What really happens is when you turn on Hyper-V, your operating system is massively modified.
Right.
First of all, you're no longer running Windows. The thing you boot is this 600K chunk of code called the Windows Hypervisor. And it's an operating system that doesn't have a command line interface. It doesn't have a UI. There's really no way to talk to it, which I think is one of the reasons why it has been that secure in the last 10 years, is that it's not easy to get to. And that part's okay. I remember hearing that, but sort of dismissing it.
This is that whole hypervisor concept they called Ring Zero, too, right? They actually...
Ring minus one.
Yeah, minus one. Like, actually, before the OS you know and love comes into play, we're here. And we're interacting with the BIOS and now Eufy. And then comes the OS you think you're running.
Yes, that's absolutely right. But I think, and you're smarter than I am, so maybe you didn't make this mistake, but I was thinking in terms of Ring minus one was important so that we could lie to those virtual machines and say, yes, you're in control of Ring Zero. You are the man, dude, you know?
Yeah.
That stuff's obvious. What Microsoft calls the child virtual machine. So if I have a Windows, let's make it clear, okay? So if I have a Windows 10 box And let's say I'm going to run a copy of Server 2016 beta, and I'm going to run a copy of Virtual XP because I want to run something. Okay. So I've got my little computer. I'm running Windows 10. I've got my games. I've got my drivers. I've got my apps. And then I open up Hyper-V, and there's my 2016 beta with TPM. And there's my XP thing I need for now and then. That's the model I see.
Right.
It's right, but it's incomplete. It turns out that I'm not running two virtual machines, XP and 2016. I'm running Windows 10. Because the Windows 10 that I'm running, that I think is my computer, because, hey, I was running Windows 10 for 6 months before I turned on Hyper-V, let's say. I know what my desktop looks like. I know what my apps look like. I know how it handles drivers. It's my physical, it's my operating system. When I turn on Hyper-V, though, that's not what happens. Hyper-V is my operating system. I never see it. It never manifests itself.
Right.
My copy of Windows that I used to think was a so-called physical copy of Windows now becomes a virtual one. It's a special virtual machine. It's called the parent virtual machine. Mm-hmm. But it is a virtual machine nonetheless. And the hypervisor, because it doesn't want to deal with drivers, it delegates that to my special virtual machine, again, which is, again, called the parent virtual machine.
That's also why that hypervisor is going to stay so robust. There's just no way to insert foreign code into it in the form of a driver or anything else.
It's exactly right, because when we talk about, for example, how does Mimikatz work? The way Mimikatz works is that in our Windows world, it's been true for decades that there's two kinds of code. There's user mode code and there's kernel code. And user mode code is stuff like Outlook and Word and things like that. But kernel mode code is the operating system, the multitasking scheduler, the memory manager. We forget the drivers.
Right.
Any old driver. You know, you buy some junky fingerprint reader with a driver written by some guy in his basement that has the same amount of power as the operating system you bought Microsoft, right?
Well, and the whammy for Vista back in the day was video drivers, also running in Ring Zero and entirely too powerful. And they just shredded machines when they were bad.
My recollection was that was about the remote video stuff. Because what Microsoft did, I vaguely recall that Vista was the first version of terminal services that let you remote the graphics command. So the notion is with like XP, if you say draw a circle, the work done to get the circle drawn is on the master machine.
Right.
Whereas with Vista, if you were RDPing into Vista, the command to draw a circle didn't happen on that machine you're RDPing to. It got shot across the wire and done locally. That's the theory. And remember, Vista was big about GPUs, right?
Right.
Vista was more heavily reliant on GPUs. I think that's real. I don't know that it was so much that it was bad drivers. It was just that the drivers writers were working with radically different hardware.
Yes.
And I think they just hadn't figured it out yet.
And a new set of rules. Like, they had a hard time. No two ways about it. But we're off track. I mean, I'm with you.
No, wait. Let me sew this up with one little piece, though.
Okay.
In their defense, it's Microsoft's fault. No, we have four rings. We have 0, 1, 2, 3. 3 has the least power. That's where the apps sit. 0 has the most power. That's where the kernel sits. Mm-hmm. Drivers go in ring 0. That's stupid. OS 2 was built with the kernel. The actual code written by Microsoft and IBM, the stuff that someone actually checked in Ring 0. Then in Ring 1 is the drivers. You get a third-party driver, all it can do is kill itself.
Right.
That was a brilliant idea, but they went away from that. So that, I mean, many of the stability and security issues we've had could have been fixed if Microsoft had moved the drivers into Ring 1 a long time ago. Anyway.
But they complained about performance.
No, that's absolutely not true. That's absolutely not true. The reason that they did it was the very first computer that they built NT on was the MIPS processor, and it only had one bit. It only had two rings, 0 and 1.
Right.
That's the only reason that happened. No, when I talked to Cutler, he knew this is ages ago. This is 1992. I talked to Cutler about this, and he didn't like talking about it, but he said, yeah, we would use three rings if we had them, but we made this run on the MIPS processor first. So, you know, it's kind of interesting. A sidebar to the sidebar, but still an interesting one, is one of the best parts about Windows 8 was that Microsoft decided that they were going to take the Windows kernel and put it on ARM.
Right.
And if you think about it, Richard, over the years, 5 people used the PowerPC version of Windows. You know,
yes.
Me and 7 other guys used the alpha version.
Yep.
But every time Microsoft ports Windows to a different platform, it's a good thing because it forces them to look at every, and they're like, holy crap, there's this thing that's been in the corner for 15 years, you know?
Yeah, and they dragged it back out again.
People always laugh. Who cares about this? Who cares about this? You're going to get a much better copy of Windows the next time this stuff is happening. And I truly wish that we would see a Ring 1 driver model one day, but I'll shut up about it and let's keep moving. So, I mean, so one of the things that brings us to this problem is that drivers can do anything. They're the scary part. They're Ring 0. What do we do? Well, that's why we surrender. We stop trusting the operating system, and instead we have this little tiny operating system that we do trust.
Right.
But let's go back to that hyperresist story though. When you turn on Hyper-V, again, you never see it. It never manifests if you're a user,
no,
even an expert user. But the fact is that when your system boots, here's what happens, is that first, a hypervisor seizes control, has everything. It loads the parent VM, that's your Windows,
mm-hmm,
and it hands trust to it. And then blah, 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 blah. And then you've got virtual machines and so on. We don't trust those as much, the child virtual machines. Here's the small difference. This is one of those cases where a tiny, tiny change in Windows gives us awesome stuff. In Windows 10, when you load Hyper-V, it doesn't trust the parent. Because your question to me was, wait a minute, Mark, how can I have some memory that's got secrets in it, and it's on my friggin' memory chips? How is it that my Windows, which is running on my computer, can't see my memory? The answer is, your Windows does see it, but your Windows is named Hypervisor, and it doesn't talk to you.
Right. And you're not really talking to it either.
Exactly. Exactly. Because you're sitting in a parent, it's still more powerful than the average, in a parent virtual machine that still has many powers and abilities far beyond those of other virtual machines, but is by no way a physical operating system anymore.
Right.
And that means that it's possible for the hypervisor to say, oh, memory? Ain't nobody here but us chickens. No, you can't see that memory.
That doesn't exist.
It's wonderful. It's just so cool. The other thing, too, by the way, you won't be surprised about this, but if you've got this stuff set up, if you fire up PowerShell on your Windows 10 box and you do a get-vm, it doesn't show you the little magic guy.
Right.
It's only shows itself in that's the one bad part about teaching about this or writing about it, is there's nothing to show you.
Right. I just have to tell you all this stuff exists and it's going to be okay.
Well, we have a few. There's a few manifestations. But anyway, so what's interesting about this is that step one to turning on virtual secure mode, and that's the generic phrase for all these four things,
mm-hmm,
is actually messing with BCD edit.
Holy cow.
Yeah.
That's a blast from the past.
Yeah. Well, there's lots of cool stuff that you do with it. I don't know if we ever talked about my steadier state tool. It involved a tremendous amount of study of BCD edit, so I found this quite interesting. The first thing you do is you type BCD edit /set VSM launch type auto. So it's this that's a new command that says, hey, if you ever turn on Hyper-V, if Hyper-V is ever running on your system, it doesn't trust the parent.
Hmm.
I think just so cool. So in order to make this work, first of all, are you ready for the bad news? Is everyone sitting down? You have to be using the enterprise version of Windows 10.
Boo!
Guess. If you're a small operation, and I am, it has annoyed me for years that the only copy of enterprise Windows that I can play with is the one that I get with MSDN.
Right.
Which I'm not supposed to be using for production.
No.
And I'm a guy that follows licenses. So the best you can do with some operations is you got to go someplace, and pretty much there doesn't seem to be a way around having to buy 5 licenses, but I surrendered. And they're going to want to sell you that long-term servicing branch stuff. Don't take that.
Yes.
Take regular old Windows 10.
But you own an enterprise license.
5 of them. So, because you can't buy just one. You do that setting. You turn on Hyper-V. You go to Windows Features with those little check boxes for things.
Yep.
There's also a new thing called isolated user mode. Basically, what's happened is that this idea of isolated user mode, that's the nubbins, that's the kernel, so to speak, little k, of how this is all going. And you know what's silly is that if you turn on isolated user mode, it's of no value without Hyper-V. I sort of wish we had the same tools that we have in server. You know, whereas in server, if I say I want X, it will say, you know, you also need IIS and all this other stuff. And so I wish they would do that in Windows 10, but certainly in 2016, that stuff will be done for you automatically. So that's step one.
Right.
Is that you're now running Hyper-V, whether you realize it or not. And step two is that you've got to do that BCD edit setting. And then step three is that you have to go into device guard, which is a section in group policies, and you're really just flipping a couple of switches. Now, your first requirement is, again, Windows 10 Enterprise. You also have to have some hardware, though.
Mm-hmm.
And honestly, to get the most out of this, you're probably going to want, and you follow CPUs more closely than I do. So talk to me about IOMMU devices. I know that my Surface 4's got one. I know that my Lenovo P50 has one. I know that my Lenovo X230 doesn't. And if it's ever a question, you just download Intel CPU ID. But how long have we had those, Richard? The IOMMU, the VTXD stuff?
Oh, it's been a while. You know, they were utilized in different levels, but it was just being able to get IO devices to write directly to memory and not have to go down the long bus.
My recollection was that the first step there was SLAT, but SLAT's like 8 years ago. But the IOMMUs really, I think they're only the last two generations. So just the paradox of Windows 10 is that Windows 10 reduces the reason to buy new hardware. Because, no, seriously, we should talk about this another time, but I mean, there are a few things about Windows 10 where, you know how Microsoft always says, oh, and this version X runs in less memory than version X minus one, and you're like, I don't really notice it. Windows 10 has this handful of things where you could take crappy old Windows 7 boxes and put Windows 10 on them, add an SSD, and you've got a new computer. So
yeah, it zooms.
So while there will be the great temptation to want to stay with the old stuff, which is probably a great thing, if you want the full features of this new VSM stuff, virtual secure mode, then you should be thinking about picking up some newer hardware. So we're looking for an IOMMU. That's the Intel name. And help me out. The AMD name is what? VTXD or V?
AMD VI.
Is it AMD VI? Is that what it is?
Yeah. I mean, they've got a specification for IOMMU as well, but I guess they call it AMD VI.
The reason that you want that is that that gives you the absolutely you can't stop me protection from the DMA devices.
That's really interesting.
It's really.
And I mean, and I'm just looking this up here. There's lots of motherboards now built with this, but it's only recent chipsets.
Right. Last two, right?
Something like that. I mean, I'm looking at a dozen chipsets that Intel's got and even more that AMD's got.
Yeah.
So there, and we're recording this in mid-June of 2016. Like, obviously, this is moving fast.
Yes.
So they've clearly decided that IOMMU is important, and pretty much everything we're going to get coming forward is going to have it on there. Same thing. Now here's a list of video cards. So current generation video cards all have IOMMU in them.
Oh, I didn't know that. It makes sense once you say it. That's because that's one of the biggest IO memory locations.
Yeah, no kidding.
Here's a case where I'm sorry, but I really have to beat up Microsoft on this. They do this where they'll come out with some new security doodad, and it only works in Enterprise or in the old days, Ultimate.
Right.
Why do we not have Ultimate anymore? How ridiculous. Anyway.
You missed Ultimate? I think you might be the only one.
Well, no, wait. Hang on. Okay. So I'm not a big operation.
Right.
I don't need 5 Windows licenses.
Yes.
But I want all the features.
Yes.
Now, it used to be that Ultimate was just all the features for a hobbyist or a small operation.
Mm-hmm.
I have to have Enterprise, which means I've got to buy 5 copies of Windows, which I don't need.
Right.
It's just, but, and the point is, when the new security stuff comes around, Microsoft's ostensible shtick is that, well, we think security is really important, but I got to pay a lot of money for it. Really? Seriously? And the only reason the security problem is because your operating system's got bugs in it.
Yeah, it doesn't sound like something you should be charging for at all. Everybody should have this.
That's exactly right. I'm hoping that I'm not announcing a version of Windows. I don't know anything about it, but we're looking at the first anniversary of July 26th in about, 4 weeks?
Right.
And that was when Windows 10 first came out. It also means that those of you that have been waiting to upgrade to Windows 10 for free, well, here's your last chance. And for those of you who have been annoyed about the fact that you don't want to upgrade, I'm guessing that in a month it'll get better. Because it'll stop bothering you.
But it does speak to these new security models that have been incorporated here and just aren't visible. I mean, I appreciate you just bringing it out.
It's so awesome. And let's take it a step further. So what are our two things here? Is that, first of all, so the Trustlet – oh, I'm sorry. There's a magic word for these guys. The four applications, they're called Trustlets.
Trustlets. What a great name.
It is. So Trustlet 0 says basically turn on secure kernel. And you'll know that that's working because in your list of services, you'll see secure kernel. And that's got that supports something called device guard, which I'll get to if we have time. But the secure kernel is more important than device guard, in my opinion. Then number one, that's called credential guard.
Right.
And it protects your secrets. And the reason you know that it's running is that there is a service called LSA ISO, the Isolated Local Security Authority Subsystem. So these are just names of services. And that's when you try your Mimikatz stuff and it will not work. 2 and 3, that is numbers 3 and 4 because it starts from 0, are really interesting because they are Hyper-V improvements. Now, if you've had someone want to talk about this, then shut me up. One of the things we never talk about is who runs your virtual infrastructure.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if it's a person who's working for the same company as you, then you could probably trust them
mm-hmm.
a bit. But here's a scenario that wouldn't be fun. What if one of our domain controllers, I'm giving you the simplest one I can think of, one of our domain controllers is a virtual machine. Now, a virtual machine is nothing more than an imaginary computer that's got an imaginary drive that is really a file.
Right.
That's called a virtual hard drive or something like that. What stops your Hyper-V administrator, or your ESX administrator for that matter, from shutting that computer down for just a second, copying the C drive? I'm assuming they're lazy like everybody else and their NTDS, their Active Directory NTDS is on the C drive. And just copying that VHD, start the thing back up, and now take that VHD home. You're mounting it as a drive, and you run any of the password crackers.
Right. And you'll have all the time in the world to hack away at it.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And you can imagine even scarier scenarios. What do we do about this? Because it's always like we start out by saying we trust all of our administrators, but then in life teaches us that that might be a little broad-based.
Sure. And this is a conversation that we're having now as we talk about some of these new features in Hyper-V that, you know, how do we secure infrastructure from our administrators?
But it's not just our administrators, Richard, because my web server is now an Azure virtual machine.
Sure.
I took the thing, I stuffed it up there. And so any, I can't imagine anyone giving a hoot about from Microsoft, but still, you know, one, I'm just a tenant.
Yeah.
And what keeps a bored Azure administrator from copying my VHDs in the same way? So whether it's, you know, Rackspace or whether it's Mark and Richard Inc. or whether it's Azure, it would be nice to have a tool. And so the logical answer is that these VHDs and virtual hard drives are essentially hard drives. Well, why can't we BitLocker them? That sounds like a great idea.
Yep.
But the problem is BitLocker, and you see, isn't this a great callback? We started talking about BitLocker and you were thinking, why is he talking about 10-year-old technology? And here it comes right back. I'll tell you. So how do we do this? Well, they wanted to create virtual TPM chips in Hyper-V. And if you think about it, you can't trust the virtual machines. So what you do is you have a separate server called the host guardian service. And the host guardian service holds those BitLocker keys. And so the VM administrator can't screw with this thing. It's one of these virtual machines wakes up and says, hey, I have a locked virtual machine. Can I get the BitLocker key?
Nice.
And, yeah, exactly. And so there's two pieces to it. One is the save data in the virtual TPM and then retrieve data in the virtual TPM. I know that we're running way over time, and I apologize. I'll try to wrap this up. But what's interesting to me is, first of all, this is fascinating as an operating system feature. It's a really, really cool idea. It exploits an idea that's 10 years old, that's never really been leaned on terribly strongly. It gives us four basic good starting points. But I can't wait to see what we're going to get in the future.
Yeah.
I mean, how much further we'll be able to take this stuff. It's just
there's more to go on from here. Absolutely.
Absolutely.
It's fascinating stuff.
And you can hear about this and much more if you take my 2-day Windows 10 technical support class, which you can read about at www.manassi, that's MINASI.com.
Awesome. It's great to see some new curriculum up here, dude. You've been busy.
I have. It's been so much fun. I love teaching PowerShell because for a lot of reasons, but it's like, literally millions of IT pros have purchased my books, and if they hadn't, I would have had to get a job, and I don't think I could have handled that. So,
you and me both.
Exactly. But I there are times that I strongly feel like there are places that we aren't that we need to be, and I've been pushing automation since the 90s, but a lot of the objections, you know, it's hard because of X, Y, and Z, a lot of objections go away with PowerShell.
Nice.
And that's what I'm trying to drag people into. I just did a class at a client a couple of weeks ago, and it was a room full of people, and it was interesting. The 25-year-olds were excited in the back and that sort of thing, but the guys that were saying, can I retire before I have to learn this stuff? I wish you could be in the room because you would enjoy this, because everybody's scared witless. It's a 2-day class.
Yeah.
Everybody's scared when they get started. And I spend like 2.5-3 hours just up front on syntax and what the tab key does, and we take one commandlet and we just do it to death. And my promise to them is, you know how that first GUI that you ran, Solitaire, taught you half of what you needed to be an Active Directory administrator? Because,
right,
you know, up in the corner, that little X does the same thing all the time, and the menus look the same. And PowerShell's like that. And if you learned one commandlet, it's not a silo. You have information, you have wisdom that you can take to your next one. And they're fascinated. By the end of the class, they're guessing the names of the commandlets, of course, but also they're realizing that how powerful it can be, and that you don't have to be a coder. You don't have to be a coder. The more you learn, the more you can do, but that it's, to rephrase it, there's so many situations where the world does something to us IT pros, and it's like, oh, we didn't want to do this, and I hate my job a little more than I did before, and I don't like that. And if I can find a place where people are hating it less and enjoying it, because, well, you've done PowerShell, It's scripting tools are great. It's the best one around as far as I'm concerned.
Yes, very. It's very powerful stuff. And we're going to be together at IT Edge Intersection at the end of October in Las Vegas.
We are. That's right. I'm not sure what we're doing, but
I'm sure we're going to be up to the usual trouble. I've got Vice President Brad Anderson committed for a keynote.
Oh, very good. Very good.
Yeah. And tech fellow Jeffrey Snover's on board. So it's going to be a heck of a roster. And of course, the indomitable Mark Manassi.
Well, you know, whenever Snover's up there, Snover's always a great guy to listen to.
Mm-hmm.
Because, how can I say this nicely without being banned from campus forever? You know, 90 out of 100 Microsoft presenters just can't. It always sounds like a sales pitch. It's we're doing this, that, and the other thing. Snover is one of those guys who can say, you know, we recognize we screwed up on this particular thing.
Right.
We've been thinking about this. And 15 years ago, I thought about this. And what about if we did this? And there's a handful of guys that are like that. I mean, yes, he's selling something, but and yes, it's going to cost. It's new stuff to learn. But in most cases, it's being taken along on the story. One of the few guys who can compete with Douglas Crockford, if you've ever heard Crockford
right.
speak. And if you haven't out there, I hate the idea of JavaScript. I don't want to learn it. But every time I listen to Crockford, he invented it. And he's just, he has such a giant brain.
Yeah. And such a good thinker on that. It gives you confidence.
You always walk away saying, oh, he's right. We should be doing it differently or something.
It's exact. We had him at the spring show at Dev Intersection. And I believe he's at the fall show as well. So, you know, all you got to do is come to the one conference. You'll get the Doug Crockford, the Mark Manassi, and the Jeffrey Snover. The thing, Snover is a tech fellow now. He's talking about what he's going to build. Importantly, convince the whole organization to build.
So I met Snover back in 2002. But when he had done WMIC, if you recall that.
Yeah.
And then about, I don't know, 6 months later, he said, you're going to be on campus sometime. I said, yeah, in a couple of weeks. And he showed me PowerShell. This is like April of 2003. Server 2003 is just shipped. And he, none of that, he takes me through this entire like insane 10, 12 master plan for taking over the universe. And I always love those things, but they never happen.
It's not going to come true, but it's an awesome story.
And, you know, and the end of the story was desired state configuration. And he did all those things. And they're,
he's done it all.
And they're amazing. And so now we have the new 5-year plan, the great leap forward, you know, whatever. So it'll be fun to hear whatever he's got to say.
Well, you've done it again, Mark. We're fully 50% over time, and I feel like we're just getting started. There's so much more we could have talked about.
Always a pleasure, my friend. And all of you listening, thank you so much. And if you get a minute, some of you do drop me a line now and then and tell me that you like the show or want to know more. And please don't hesitate to do that. I'm at mark@manassi.com or drop a letter to Richard, and I'm sure he will get it to me. Thanks for listening, guys.
I will absolutely pass it along. Comment on the show. He'll show up there as well.
What is there a website or something?
There is, called runasradio.com. Mark, thank you so much.
You're welcome, my friend. Take care.
And we'll talk to you next week on Run As Radio.